Let's cultivate our motivation. And when we really think about what samsara is and get some sort of feeling that this is a description of our life and our lives and our past, present, and future, then practicing the Dharma becomes very important to us. If we don't have that awareness that my body and mind are samsara, and that they're under the control of afflictions and karma, without that awareness, then our mind is completely focused just on this lifetime and the matters of this lifetime. And so we feel, quote, quote, normal. But what happens is there's no urgency to our practice because everything seems quite okay, you know, except for the problems we have this lifetime. But there's no awareness of what being under the control of afflictions and karma really means and the danger that that presents to us. So that's why it's very important to understand the first two truths, true dukkha and the true origins of dukkha, in order to generate not only the aspiration for liberation, but also for bodhicitta. Because bodhicitta wants to liberate sentient beings from samsara. Doesn't just want to make them feel okay now. Okay, so bring to mind what samsara means. See if there's some feeling of the danger of being under the control of afflictions and karma and not having freedom. And then remember that's the situation of all sentient beings. And generate compassion and then bodhicitta for them. Okay, so that's why it's really important to meditate on the first two truths. Yeah, because otherwise we open our eyes, everybody looks, you know, okay. You know, what's the thing about having to get out of samsara, you know? There's all these people around, and okay, a few people have stomach aches today, but they'll get over it, and I have some problems, but, you know, other people die, I don't. And even when I die, my death is going to be special. There's not going to be any pain, no worry, no regret, you know. So we just kind of go along in our little bubble. Okay, can I share your saga? Or do you want to tell it? Yeah, give her the microphone.
So So as I sat down to work on the chart of the three turnings, the thought promptly popped into my mind, wow, how wonderful it's going to be when Venerable knows that I did my homework and then praises me in front of the whole class. And, I mean, that thought just went on and on and on. and then it switched to, but how is she going to find out? Because I'm too lazy to handwrite the chart myself. I can't print it and I can't email her, so poor me. And I had this whole pity party. And then I was like, oh, I'm just a lowly layperson. I should just stay in my lane. And it just went, I mean, on and on and on. So I decided it wasn't a good time to study Dharma at all. So I just gave it up. it was quite a... and then later during a meditation, I was looking over the sufferings in the first two truths. It occurred to me that was my problem, was really bad attachment to reputation and praise and, you know, image and all of that. And then the suffering of being separated from the beautiful, or, you know, separated from what we want. And then it occurred to me, like, that was my whole problem, and that was what the Buddha was trying to explain in the first turning of the wheel. And so this whole thing kind of brought me back to doing the chart in the first place. But I was expecting the chart to be like a very dry kind of academic thing, very black and white, but it turned out to be a more tangible thing than I was expecting. So it was quite an experience.
Yeah. So you understood why the Buddha taught the first turning of the wheel of Dharma.
At least a little bit more, yes.
Good. Who else did a chart? Good. Was it helpful?
Yeah, it's nice. Yeah.
Yeah, it was. Good. Yeah.
Of course.
Huh?
You were teasing me about my wheels.
Oh.
Very
yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. No, really, outlining things for yourself, that way you really learn it well. Yeah, and you have to think about it. And then you see how all these teachings fit together, you know. Because otherwise it seems like, well, you know, because like in a Dharma center, you know, one weekend, one person comes and you hear, you know, how to die according to highest yoga tantra. And the next weekend you hear about bodhicitta. And the weekend after that you hear about emptiness. And then the weekend after that, precious human life. And then a seminar in karma, and you get completely confused and you don't know how the things fit together. Yeah? So if you do this kind of chart, and we're, you know, I think it's in chapter 8, I can't remember, when it talks about the different ways to present the topics, you know, then this whole way of seeing how to present things and how things link together is very, very helpful. So we have a few questions from the Singaporeans who sent a very nice picture of them all sitting there holding the book and reminding me that last year when they didn't come to class because it was Chinese New Year and I scolded them, this year they came to class. So I was very proud of them. Yeah. That's very good. And they have a few new people coming too, which is very good. Okay, so they had some questions. Okay, first one about the three baskets, Vinaya, Sutra, and Abhidharma basket. So we identified them as Vinaya, the precepts for lay followers and monastics. Yeah, so the Vinaya is not only the precepts for lay followers and monastics, but it's the rites that the Sangha does. It has the stories of the origin of the precepts. It has a little bit of history in there, you know, about the first and second councils usually, but it's definitely about its emphasis is on ethical conduct. Okay, then the sutra basket. So they said Buddha's words, usually in Pali, also translated into Sanskrit, Chinese, etc. That's not not, that needs some refinement. So the sutra basket, yes, is the Buddhist word, but so is the Vinaya. Okay? So the sutra baskets are the discourses of the Buddha. Yeah. The Buddha probably taught in a language called Prakrit, or a dialect, one of the Prakrit dialects. So the teachings were written in Pali and in Sanskrit in future centuries, not immediately. Okay? And so from, they weren't translated from Pali into Sanskrit. In fact, some people think they were in Sanskrit first and then, in the south and in Sri Lanka, they put them in Pali. It's, the history is really quite uncertain. But from the Sanskrit tradition, then it went into Central Asia. So we have some teachings in Gandhari and maybe in a few other Central Asian languages, but not a lot. And then from then it went into China, mostly translated from Sanskrit, a little bit from Gandhari. It went into Tibet, again, mostly from Sanskrit, a little bit from Gandhari, and also some from Chinese. Okay? And then from China, it went to Japan and Korea, and then south into Vietnam also. From Sri Lanka, then it went into Southeast Asia and into Indonesia. It also, the Sanskrit tradition also went into Indonesia. Yeah, probably as people were going from China to India, from India back to China, because the place where we were at in Sumatra, they said that the Chinese monks often stopped there on their way to Nalanda to learn Sanskrit. So, okay. So just to clarify, you know, the sutra basket, has a lot of different discourses that the Buddha gave. And the sutra basket, we have the different canons in Pali, in Chinese, in Tibetan. There's overlap about the sutras in those three, particularly the Chinese and the Pali tradition have overlap in terms of the Nikayas and the Agamas, and the Chinese and the Tibetans have overlap in terms of the Mahayana sutras. Okay? And then there's also a few sutras that made it here and there, you know. So there's overlap in the three canons. And the three canons are different than the three baskets. Okay, the three baskets have to do with the topics. The canons are accumulations of the Buddha's word and also the some of the writings of the early sages. Okay, then the Abhidharma basket, and they said texts that elaborate and explain the sutras to facilitate better understanding of the Dharma for different levels of being. So that's kind of, what it does. The Abhidharma in particular is finding, it's a lot of, how to say, it talks about the structure of the universe, about the afflictions, about the different stages of elimination of the afflictions, about the different kinds of karma. It goes into a lot comparing different things, the two of this and the three of that, and dividing different mental states into their component parts and so on. So in that way, it's designed to help understand the sutras. But sometimes the Abhidharma itself is hard to understand. Yeah. Depends. Okay. And then, so I hope that clears up about the three baskets. Then they asked, what is the relationship of Lamrim and Abhidharma? Okay. So the Abhidharma texts were written very early on. And like we said, we don't really know if those were the Buddha's words. People have different, ideas about it. Many people think it was written by the early arhats or sages, and there's different versions of the Abhidharma. But the Abhidharma isn't, a book, so much a book that you would sit down and read by yourself just to get an understanding of what the Dharma's about. It's a book that you would sit down and study after you have heard a lot of teachings and you want more details about things. So the Abhidharma was put together quite early on. The Lamrim is originated in Tibet, and so it came about much later after the Abhidharma. And the idea of the Lamrim was that people have done a lot of study of the great treatises. They've studied the sutras. They've studied a lot of the commentaries about the sutras and the treatises about the sutras. And they've studied Vinaya and so forth. And now they want some kind of condensed thing that highlights all the important points so that they can take that and then really go and do some serious practice. So that's how the Lamrim was written and who it's designed for. Okay. So we're usually taught the Lamrim, but the Lamrim is actually meant for people who have a lot of Buddhist background already, who have studied a lot of the classic things and want a concise summary. So the concise summary part of the Lamrim is really beneficial for us, but it doesn't include the material that those of us who are new to Buddhism need. We need a lot of background material. First, if you don't have that background material, then you really don't understand the topics in the Lamrim. So that's what this series is trying to do, is to give people, a lot of the background material and then go into the Lamrim and then also rearrange a few of the Lamrim topics in a way that we think corresponds to how people think nowadays, in the sense that, for example, in the usual Lamrim structure, the topic of refuge comes fairly early on. And there's no problem with that because all these people are Buddhists already. But in the West, the topic of refuge comes early on. And we found, when we, like with our SAFE course, Srivasti Abhi Friends Education, when we put the thing on refuge in the usual thing, the feedback we got from the students was, we don't understand this. This is too difficult. Because it's talking about, the qualities of the Buddha and, things and it's just kind of beyond people. But what people were really interested in at that point in their studies was karma. So what we did is we taught karma after death, in the Lamrim. We put karma, so karma's in volume 2, and then refuge is in volume 4, because in volume 3, then we taught the, what did we do in volume 3? I'm getting it all confused now. Volume 3 was about the Four Noble Truths. It was about 3 of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, true dukkha, true origin, true cessation. And then true paths gets you into talking about refuge, because the Dharma refuge is the last 2 of the Four Noble Truths. So, we finished that in the first 3 Noble Truths in volume 3, then volume 4, put the true paths and put refuge there. Okay, and then went on to do the three higher trainings. Okay, and a lot of the material in the three higher trainings in the Lamrim, yeah, the part about refuge is very short in the Lamrim. The part about concentration, the second highest training, they usually save that way for the end of the Lamrim, but we put it in here in the actual three higher trainings. Because a lot of people who are new to the Dharma, they want to develop their concentration a little bit. Maybe not to the point of serenity, but, you know, they're already doing some meditation. They want to do that more. So we move those teachings up from the perfection of meditative stability up and put them into the higher training of concentration. Okay. And so, you know, there was some rearrangement according to how we thought it would be good for people to practice. Okay, but now we're back on volume 1, which is some of the yes?
Can I ask one question about the chart?
Sure.
I guess that's part of the value of doing a chart because I missed this when you taught it, but to see that Nagarjuna's praises is listed as one of the texts that's included within the third turning of the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how Nagarjuna got into a third turning of Buddha's teachings. Maitreya I could buy because it's attributed to Maitreya, but why is Nagarjuna there?
Okay, well, you have to remember that the Tibetans say Nagarjuna lived 600 years. So they attribute a lot of stuff to Nagarjuna. The initial Nagarjuna, who lived in like the second or third century, was the one who taught all about emptiness. Okay, it's coming here because His Holiness says he doesn't really think Nagarjuna lived 600 years. But that's standard thing in the Tibetan tradition. And so that's why in the, what is it, Bodhicitta Vāravana, the commentary on Bodhicitta, he's refuting some of the Chittamatra tenets. But Chittamatra came after the original Nagarjuna. So probably there were more than one Nagarjuna. Yeah. Over that 600-year period, there was probably more than one. Yeah. And I mean, hey, what's wrong? There's lots of people who have the same name.
Yeah, it wasn't the timing. It was the words of the Buddha or not. For the third turning of the wheel.
What? It was... I don't understand what you're asking.
I mean, if the Buddha... There were three turnings of the wheel.
Yeah.
I guess that third turning... I mean... I also thought they were all attributed to the Buddha.
Yeah. So where are you seeing that Nagarjuna's praises are in the third turning?
In your book.
Where?
Second paragraph
from the top. What page?
102.
It's the basis.
I see.
Okay. It's the basis for those. It's not saying that those texts are in the third turning. Okay. Okay. Because those texts would be in the Tengir, not in the Kangir.
Yeah.
Okay. So the authenticity of the Mahayana scriptures. At the first council, which occurred soon after the Buddha's passing, neither the Mahayana sutras nor the tantras were recited or included in the collection of sutras. Because the Mahayana sutras and Vajrayana tantras in the Sanskrit tradition were initially not widely known, doubts were later raised about their authenticity. Hello? Personally speaking, I am fully convinced that the Buddha taught these sutras and tantras Amongst the greatest of these sutras, the Prajnaparamita sutras explicitly teach emptiness and implicitly teach the bodhisattva paths and stages to awakening. According to the traditional account, these sutras were spoken by the Buddha and then taken for safe custody to the land of the Nagas, dragon-like beings that dwell in lakes or near streams. Because the people at that time were not yet suitable vessels to fully understand them. The great Buddha sage Nagarjuna, that's how he got his name, okay, then retrieved them from the Nagas and brought them to our world, where they were widely disseminated in India. Okay. According to this account, Nagarjuna lived over 600 years. I do not believe that Nagarjuna lived that long. Being fully awakened, surely Shakyamuni Buddha must have had the ability to extend his lifespan, but he did not do this. Thus, it seems strange, not to mention improbable, that Nagarjuna would live so long. Yeah, why would he do something that the Buddha himself didn't do? Regarding his going to the Nagaland to retrieve the Prajnaparamita Sutras, I do not fully believe this, but neither can I deny it. Some people say the Prajnaparamita Sutras and other Mahayana scriptures were made up later and attributed to the Buddha. To me, both of those explanations are extreme. Okay, that they're made up and, you know, attributed. And, you know, that they were in the under the ocean with the Nagas. Born in South India, Nagarjuna visited Bodh Gaya and lived at a learning center in Magadha, both of which are located in northern India. So he was born in the south. He traveled all through India to get up to the north. So he met a lot of people. He came in contact with a lot of different texts. Okay, so he knew the situation of Buddhism in India at his time. During his extensive travels, he must have come in contact with the Prajnaparamita Sutras and began to gather them together. Nagarjuna was a Sanskrit scholar as well as an upstanding Buddhist monk. As such, he would never lie. He knew that some people doubted the authenticity of the Mahayana teachings. Using reasoning, he investigated whether they were authentic. Since Nagarjuna lived only a few centuries after the Buddha, it would have been easier for him to research and establish the validity of the Sanskrit sutras than it is for us nearly 26 centuries later. Having done a thorough examination, he was convinced that they were the Buddha's word. So I find this argument of His Holiness quite convincing, because Nagarjuna, I mean, when you read his works, he's somebody who's incredible. You know that he's a practitioner. You know he's somebody who's really serious and very wise. And there would be no reason for him to lie. Yeah. And so if he traveled all through India, looked at all these texts, met people from, you know, practicing in different ways, and did some research about the sutras that they were relying on, and, you know, read the Prajnaparamita Sutras, then surely, you know, he would be able to discern if they were the words of the Buddha or if somebody made them up. Yeah. And if they were made up, he would have said so. Because, you know, when you read, you know, when you read his karikas, it's you know, somebody who can write that is not going to make something up and not going to lie and not going to kind of overlook things. Mm. Okay. But see, that comes after you've that kind of assure, you know, kind of faith in what Nagarjuna says comes after you've studied his stuff. Yeah. And before you've studied it, then it's like, well, Nagarjuna said that, yeah, so. But, you know, after you've studied some of it and you've seen the profundity, that's when, you know, okay, if Nagarjuna gave it the stamp of approval, I'll accept that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Nagarjuna, but also, for me, if you, you know, whatever the Prajnaparamita Sutras are teaching, when even, you know, I haven't read all the Prajnaparamita Sutras, they're quite long, but I've had teachings on their content, and when you hear the teachings on what they explain, the subject matter is so amazing that, you know, how could you say that this was not the words of the Buddha? If this wasn't the words of the Buddha, then who in the world could write that? Yeah. Okay. Nagarjuna's writings contain many quotations from the Prajnaparamita Sutras. Knowing that the controversy was due to a lack of awareness, he quoted extensively from these sutras when he composed the Compendium of Sutras and the Precious, and in the Precious Garland, he made special effort to demonstrate why these scriptures were authentic. So do you remember that in the, I think it was it chapter 5, he had a huge section, maybe 4, chapter 4, 3?
Yeah, 4 is
Yeah, but I don't. I remember it being later. Check. Maybe it was in 5 then. I can't remember exactly. But anyway, okay, it was in Precious Garland. Okay. And he went into it quite extensively. If he had doubt about their validity, he would never have done this. Seeing that these remarkable teachings were on the verge of extinction, with great compassion, he propagated them because he knew that the people of his own and future generations would benefit tremendously from the wisdom in them. And when you look, especially his treatise on the middle way, the Karikas, you can see that he read the early sutras, not necessarily the Pali ones. He might have read them in another language, but those very early sutras, because some of the arguments he used are the same in the sutras. It really blew me away when I was reading from the Pali canon. And one time the Buddha was, somebody asked the Buddha about the origin of dukkha, and, you know, where did it come from? And the conversation got into, well, it didn't arise from itself. It didn't arise from other. It didn't arise from both. It didn't arise causelessly. This is the most famous verse, the first verse in the Karikas, you know, and there it was, you know, a similar refutation in the Pali Canon. It wasn't repeated widely in the Pali Canon, but it was right there, you know. So I think the Buddha must have had contact with that, you know. And there's other things that he said too. Yeah? 380. So that's chapter 4. Okay. So that's the chapter on royal policy and everything, isn't it? Yeah, so he snuck in the authenticity of the Dharma in there. The Buddha taught the Prajnaparamita Sutras to a select group of monastics, as well as to bodhisattvas and other beings reported to have been in the audience. These teachings were given at Vulture's Peak, a site that is too small to accommodate the large number of listeners who reportedly attended. Thus, we must understand the delivery of those sutras on a different level, not the ordinary level. So this is a key point here, okay? And I think this is why, unless you see these sutras and the tantras given on a different level, in a different form, for a different audience, without seeing it in that way, then it makes it difficult to accept that they were the Buddha's words taught while he was alive. Okay. While some human disciples were present when he taught the Prajnaparamita Sutras, many beings who heard those sutras were not visible to the ordinary human eye. Some were great bodhisattvas, such as Avalokiteshvara, Manjushri, and Samantabhadra. Okay? So, you know, there were lots of people there, you know, sitting in the sky, invisible, you know, and then a few human beings probably fitting into that small space. Because the contingent of human beings listening to these teachings was comparatively small, and the teachings are radical in their presentation of emptiness, they were passed down from teacher to student privately and were not known to the general public for many centuries. Why it is generally accepted that the Vinaya and Sutra teachings were passed on orally, I believe the Prajnaparamita Sutras may have been written down early on. Although literacy was not widespread, surely some bhikshus knew how to read and write. And I was also thinking, you know, Ashoka, he lived 3rd century BC. And he had all these edicts, you know, and things carved in the pillars. So definitely at Ashoka's time, there was writing. And it was throughout the kingdom because he had all these pillars. So that was actually quite close to the, you know, if the Buddha was in the 5th century, not the 6th century, then this was only 2 centuries after the Buddha. Okay, so it makes sense, you know, if they had it there, then other people had reading and write, you know, knew how to read and write, so they could record this and keep it very privately. Because so few people knew about these teachings, they almost fell into obscurity. Nagarjuna came into contact with, reproduced, and disseminated the Prajnaparamita Sutras. The latter dissemination of previously little-known texts has occurred several times in the history of Buddhism. During the Cultural Revolution, many texts in Tibet were destroyed, but later someone found one copy of a text and made many copies. In that way, the teaching was preserved. Similarly, texts and Buddhist artifacts dated from the 4th to the 12th centuries were hidden in the Dunhuang Caves, only to be rediscovered in the 20th century and taken to the British Museum, where others came to know of them. Scriptures written in Gandhari that date to the 1st century were found in pots and discovered only in recent years. It seems to me that something similar could have happened in ancient India. The Prajnaparamita Sutras would have been relatively unknown for several centuries and then revived due to Nagarjuna's interest in them and his compassion for us. So that makes sense too. You know, I mean, especially in the Dunhuang Caves, I mean, they found things, yeah, from the 4th century. That were made in the 4th century, and they discovered them in the 20th century, and they hadn't decayed because somebody, I mean, it makes you wonder, like, okay, who was there and how was that person thinking that they took certain scriptures and put them in pots and made the pots airtight so that the scriptures wouldn't fall apart and decay? And these scriptures, you know, I think I told you about Venerable Tianchang, yeah, and going with her one day to watch at UW what they were doing with some of these old Gandhari sutras, you know, that were found just, you know, in the last few decades, and yet they're centuries old. And okay, those texts are kind of falling apart, but they're, you know, there's enough there so they could see what the topics are and what's going on. And so it makes you think, well, who was it that, you know, had the idea to put some texts in pots And how did they do it to make it so that the whole thing didn't totally decay in, you know, 17, 18, 19 centuries? It's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing. So, you know, how many of us put things in pots for future generation? Yeah, and it makes you think, you know, okay, how are they thinking? Yeah, is that normally how they just shared their sutras and they just had to run away very quickly and left them behind? And or did they actually plant them there thinking that Buddhism may get destroyed and that future generations may come and find the text? Yeah, really, you know, these people that came before us, what were they thinking? How did they do things? Yeah. Did somebody just do this on their own, or did they go and run to the abbot and say, you know, to the abbot or the abbess, can I have some extra sutras that are on these leaves? I want to put them in a pot so that people can find them in future centuries and take them to University of Washington. You know, and the abbot goes, where's University of Washington? I never heard of that. Yeah. Yeah. And when you go in the caves in Dunhuang, they're absolutely amazing, you know. And as you walk in, you know, they're a big thing, and there's bodhisattvas that are taller than you are standing in those caves, you know, the statues of the bodhisattvas, and there's murals on the wall. And it's like, who painted these? Who built them? What did they think was going to happen? You know, did they close up the caves themselves to protect these? Or did the sand and the environment seal them up? It makes you wonder.
Geographically, where are these caves?
Okay, the Dunhuang Caves are on the Northern Silk Road. Okay, if you're going to Jining, they're to the west part of Jining, kind of in the Gobi Desert, isn't it? Gobi Desert is up there, and yeah, so up there on the Silk Road. And nowadays, it's all sand. I mean, it's just sand and sand and sand, and a few places with a little bit of growth, but that's my memory from being there. A lot of sand dunes. Yeah, so hopefully, I mean, the climate must have really changed, because to have that many people, because it must have taken them a long time to build these things. Yeah, I don't know if they excavated the caves or if the caves were there, but some of the statues are carved right into the caves. And so, I mean, it took a long time to build these. So you would think there must have been some vegetation and a nice climate so that the people could live. There was a group of Singaporeans going on pilgrimage, and they invited me to come with, and I said yes, because I really wanted to go to these pilgrimage sites. Yeah, there's some amazing sites in China, yeah, and also in Tibet. And, of course, many things that were destroyed, both in China and in Tibet. But, yeah, it's amazing when you think of what these people did. And, of course, you know, it was usually the king who commissioned it. Yeah, so the king got the credit, but he probably didn't do anything except pay the bill. But, you know, you think of all these people who, you know, we don't even know their names, we don't know anything about their lives, but their whole lives were dedicated to building, you know, these things, sculpting these scriptures, sculpting these statues, copying out the scriptures. Yeah. And we complain when we have to photocopy something and it takes too long. Can you imagine, you know, writing out a sutra, you know, word by word. And then, you know, you get to the end of the thing and it's like, oh no, I forgot a line in there. What do I do? You know, and you don't have a computer to go back and put it in. Or I said, this is not when it should be, this is. And it's like, how do I take off the not? And, you know, my handwriting was terrible. My sculpting of the letters was terrible today. I was in a bad mood. So these were real living beings. I mean, people with lives and feelings, and you know, and we're connecting with them, and they're connecting with us. Even though we live, you know, so many centuries apart and in such different kind of lives, but we really owe something to them. The Buddha did not teach the Prajnaparamita Sutras and other Mahayana Sutras publicly because it would not have been suitable to teach certain disciples, namely those focused on their own liberation, rather than the liberation of all. Additionally, people who were inclined to meditate on the selflessness of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person would not have been interested in teachings on the emptiness of all phenomena. The Buddha would never force either the goal of Buddhahood or the Madhyamaka view of emptiness on others. He respected people, and according to their present disposition, he set out the view, path, and result suitable for them so that they could practice the 37 harmonies with awakening, realize the four truths, and progress on the path to arhatship. Okay. Actually, you know, I think I told you before how His Holiness said he was sorry that more people didn't meditate on the 37 harmonies. But when I think about it, there's some kind of correspondence between the 37 harmonies and Tantra. You know, because it's mindfulness, at least, especially the four establishments of mindfulness. Mindfulness of body. In Tantra, clear appearance of yourself as the deity and developing serenity on that. Mindfulness of feelings, the generation of great bliss. Mindfulness of the mind, fundamental innate mind of clear light. Mindfulness of phenomena, yeah, the selflessness of phenomena. Yeah, there's some kind of... It's not that, you know, the 37 harmonies were here for those people, and Tantra is for an unrelated practice or something. No, there's a connection in there. Yeah. And the rest of the 37 harmonies, too, when you look at them, you know, they're all qualities we need to develop. It's not just people who are striving for arhatship who need to develop them. Bodhisattvas need to meditate and develop those qualities too.
This has to do with the first sentence in that paragraph. The Buddha did not teach the Prajnaparamita Sutras and other Mahayana Sutras publicly. I was reading this book in the library, trying to find more information about the turnings of the Dharma wheels. Uh-huh. And it was written by, he was an editor of a Buddhist journal. I think he was an academic, but he was saying that something like that contradicts the Buddha said elsewhere that he held nothing back. He didn't have a closed fist. I think this is from the Pali Canon.
No, I don't think those things are contradictory. The Buddha was certainly, he didn't hold anything back, but he saw that it's only useful to teach people what is going to benefit them at that time. You know, it's like if you have some medicine, you may have a whole ton of medicine. Does not holding anything back mean you give all the medicine to everybody? No, you see, you know what somebody is sick with, and then you give them that medicine. So, yeah, it's not that the Buddha was being stingy or something. I mean, he thought the Buddha was, well, anyway, yeah.
I think he was trying to make the argument that the Buddha was not the author of the Mahayana Sutras.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of discussion. So we're presenting the other side of that. Yeah. Yeah. But as, you know, as I think I mentioned before, you know, academic awareness of Buddhism in the West started out with the Pali Canon in Sri Lanka. And so that was the predominant view. Even after they came to know of the Mahayana teachings, the predominant view was this was early Buddhism, this is the true Dharma. And, you know, that's what they learned from the people that gave them those scriptures. So it's, but now some of the academics are changing their minds. But, I mean, I still, if you talk to some of our friends who are academics, you know, I was talking to Jay Garfield, who's definitely a Tibetan Buddhist, you know, but he was saying, oh, yeah, you know, they say that Nagarjuna was predicted in the sutras. Well, of course, that sutra was written after Nagarjuna lived. It was easy to predict him. So, you know, you find people even who are practitioners who say things like that. That's okay. You know, I don't, for me personally, I don't really care because I don't care about that argument so much because, like I said, if the Buddha didn't write the Mahayana Sutras, who in the world could have come up with them? You know, because they're so absolutely incredible what they say that how could it not be the Buddha? Yeah. And I think His Holiness makes this argument later. He says, you know, if you're saying they were written later, then there's such incredible, you know, scriptures. Then you're saying that there was somebody who was smarter than the Buddha. You know, the Buddha was enlightened, but somebody who was smarter than the Buddha came along later and wrote these things.
Yeah, I was thinking about this. And if it wasn't the Buddha who wrote them, and it was somebody later who was, you know, smarter than the Buddha, why didn't they put their name
on the sutra? Didn't they?
Why didn't they put their own name on the sutra?
Oh, because nobody, if you said the sutra was by, you know, Joe Blow, nobody would value it, you know. If you said it was by the Buddha, even you don't get personal credit, people would believe it better. Yeah. So, but I don't think that's, you know, or, I mean, well, anyway. Yeah, like I said, those sutras are so amazing that if the Buddha didn't said them, I can't imagine where they came from. Okay. Other people have the ability or the karma to see bodhisattvas, such as Avalokiteshvara, Maitreya, Tara, and Manjushri. To them, as well as to some of the devas, non-human beings, and bodhisattvas, the Buddha taught the Mahayana teachings. To an exceptional few beings who were suitable spiritual vessels to receive the tantric teachings, the Buddha taught Tantrayana by appearing as Vajradhara and the mandala, the purified environment and the deities in it. So the Buddha really taught according to the disposition and the level of spiritual development of the audience. If we accept that Shakyamuni Buddha achieved full awakening as a result of having accumulated merit and wisdom for three countless great eons, then such wonderful things are possible. Yeah, because you can see, well, I'll read on and then I'll say something. However, if the Buddha was born as an unenlightened human being, and this is according to the view of the Pali tradition, okay, he was born as an unenlightened human being who, although he became wiser and more compassionate, was not omniscient and still had a body produced by afflictions and karma, as the Buddha is depicted in the Pali scriptures, then I don't think it would have been possible for him to deliver such teachings at these high levels. Aside from the Travakas, who had a nihilistic or hedonistic view, all the spiritual practitioners and intellectuals in India at that time believed in a soul or self, an Atman. The two teachers that the Buddha studied with before he attained awakening accepted a self, and the Buddha did not encounter other wiser teachers than these. Given this situation, it would have been extremely difficult for an ordinary person by himself to discover selflessness. So what His Holiness is saying here is, if you accept the vision of the Buddha as explained in the Pali Sutras, that he was born as a prince, he was an ordinary human being, he had a flesh and blood body that arose out of afflictions and karma. Even if he was on the path of preparation, still, you know, he had a polluted body. There were no teachers around at that time who taught selflessness. Everybody believed in an Atman. And you say that the Buddha didn't attain enlightenment until age 35. Well, then how did he figure out the selflessness of phenomena himself? From whom? Because his initial teachers, who were the best teachers around, didn't both believed in an Atman. Yeah. And so how could he have discovered it himself? And then, if he only lived to be like 80 or 81, then he only had, 45 years, 46 years to teach the Dharma? And then it was all over? Okay? So if you accept that view of the Buddha's life, then you can see how those people would think, yeah, the Mahayana teachers, they're too far out. The Tantra's too far out. You know, the Buddha was an ordinary human being. He taught ordinary human beings. We're looking at this whole thing from the viewpoint of an ordinary human being, you know. But even the Theravada tradition, they accept the existence of devas and nagas. And Achan Moon, who was one of the greatest Theravada meditators, he had visions of the Buddha. In fact, one of his visions, he had a vision of the Buddha with the arhats, but the arhats were lined up instead of from seniors to juniors, from juniors to seniors. And he said, something is wrong here. So then he did some more purification. Then he did another had another vision of the Buddha and the arhats, and they were all sitting in their correct places. Yeah? So even Achan Moon. Yeah? So it's not so far out. I mean, when I was in Thailand, I was amazed, you know. Some of my Theravada friends, you know, always talking about devas and nagas and, you know, their teacher having clairvoyance and seeing where somebody was reborn. And, you know, they had lots of magical stuff. You know, sometimes some people like to present Theravada as, you know, really scientific. Yeah, none of that magical stuff. The Alcott, the British guy who was in Sri Lanka, that's how he really wanted to present it. But the forest monks, that whole Achan Cha tradition, they were dispelling ghosts, they were doing exorcisms, they could do magic things, you know? And they had devas who come and listen to their teachings. Achan Moon used to teach the devas all the time. Okay, so it's in their own tradition. Now, I don't know about then, but now it's certainly there.
The super knowledges were open.
Yeah, right. And this Buddha talked about the super knowledges in the sutras. Yeah, in the Pali sutras. So yeah, of course. Then you can see all these other realms and other kind of beings and stuff like that. Okay. Furthermore, in the nearly 2,600 years since the Buddha lived, millions of people have benefited from his teachings. Many have realized emptiness and attained arhatship and Buddhahood. I don't think someone who began that lifetime as an unenlightened human being could have had this kind of effect on the world. Yeah. In the same way, I don't think the founders of the world's other great religions were ordinary people. They too could have been manifestations of the Buddha. A manifestation of the Buddha doesn't necessarily teach Buddhism. He or she teaches what is most suitable for the audience at that time. So here we have again and again this point that the Buddha teaches according to the needs of sentient beings. And that's in the second mandala verse that we recite before teachings. That's exactly what it says. Okay. And the shower. Yeah. So that's exactly what the Buddha does. And that's what's smart to do. If you give people teachings that they're not ready for, either they're going to reject the teachings or, you know, who knows what happened, and that doesn't help anybody. Or, you give them the teachings and it's the wrong medicine because that's not what they need. That's why it's so important for us to attain realizations so that we can have that kind of wisdom and sensitivity to be able to teach what people need at that time instead of just, well, I know this topic, so I'm going to show off and tell you what I know. What ordinary human beings do with the teachings after the founder's passing is another matter, isn't it? Yeah, as we all know, I mean, Jesus would be horrified if he appeared now with what is being done in his name. Don't you think? He would be horrified. And so I think, you know, similar with the other great religious leaders. Most academic scholars see the wisdom in a religion as human knowledge, something that evolves over time, with each generation adding what it learns to the knowledge of the previous generations. My perspective is different. I think the major spiritual traditions that have been able to benefit humanity for centuries were each begun by someone with extraordinary spiritual wisdom and compassion who taught others through their own spiritual experience. And then the disciples, you know, who are ordinary human beings, they kind of made a mess and they set up religious institutions that make a mess. And this is samsara. The view of selflessness and nirvana as presented in the Sanskrit tradition is very sophisticated. In the Pali scriptures, the Buddha stated that nirvana exists and that it is attained by overcoming the afflictions and polluted karma that causes rebirth in cyclic existence. He did not give an in-depth analysis of the precise meaning of selflessness, especially the selflessness of phenomena, or the subtle characteristics of the self that is negated. So he gave, there are some portions in the first turning and in the Pali scriptures that do talk about the selflessness of the phenomena, but there's not a lot of passages like that. So it's not something that somebody who is going to notice they're not going to notice it easily. Such an analysis facilitates understanding the precise meaning of true cessation and nirvana. Yeah, so if you have an explanation of the precise meaning of selflessness and the subtle characteristics of the self that's negated, yeah, then that kind of analysis is going to give you a much better idea of what true cessations are. Yeah, and also what true path is and what nirvana is. To benefit his disciples, the Buddha needed to extensively explain the emptiness of inherent existence, and thus he gave the teachings of the second turning. In addition, because the Bodhisattva path was only briefly explained in the first turning of the Dharma wheel, the Buddha set forth the teachings in the second and third turnings of the Dharma wheel, which really elaborate on the Bodhisattva path. Someone might wonder, perhaps the deeper teachings about selflessness and more extensive teachings of the Bodhisattva path and resultant Buddhahood were not taught by the Buddha, but were composed by his followers at a later date, later time. If we say that the Buddha did not teach them, then he must have given a rudimentary teachings, and his followers refined it and deepened his insights. This would mean that his followers were more insightful and wiser than the Buddha himself. For me, this is unacceptable. In my opinion, the Buddha taught all the essential points of the path when he was alive. The Indian and Tibetan commentators in subsequent centuries drew out the meaning and implication of these points, further explicating or systematizing them in order to clarify the meaning for future generations. Okay, so all these texts that we read that were written centuries and centuries ago, you know, the people who wrote them were saying, you know, I want to help those people, yeah, who live in the 21st century. So I'm going to flesh out some of what's written in this scripture and try and make it easier for them to understand. And still we're going boom, boom. Yeah. If the Mahayana Sutras were not the Buddhist word, it would mean that the complete instructions of the Bodhisattva path do not exist in our world. Without these teachings, attaining Buddhahood would be impossible, and the efforts of millions of people in the last 2,600 years to actualize that path would have been wasted. However, over the centuries, people have generated bodhicitta and realized the emptiness of all phenomena. Many people of high spiritual capacity, some Tibetan and Chinese practitioners as well as Ajahn Mun, have experienced incredible visions of bodhisattvas and Buddhas. These people are ethical and wise individuals and do not lie. Let's see what that footnote says. Oh, it just says it is wise to investigate all spiritual claims and not naively accept them. Some people misinterpret experiences they have in meditation. Yeah, so don't accept everything you hear. Yeah, but, you know, the people who are wise and ethical, you can trust them. Okay, thus these holy beings must exist, and the scriptures explaining how to attain their realizations must be the Buddha's word. To say that the path to full awakening exists, but the teachings on how to realize it were fabricated by somebody other than the Buddha would be very strange indeed. Yeah. So that's why these people who are doing secular Buddhism, don't call it Buddhism. Call it bachelorism. You know? Name it after yourself. It's not Buddhism. It's, you know, you're inventing it. Or so rewriting the Buddha's teachings that, you know, it's you can't tell. The Mahayana motivation, the aspiration to attain full awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings, the Mahayana path of the six perfections, and the Mahayana goal of full Buddhahood are wonderful and benefit all beings. What is there to criticize in them? Good question. Yeah? When you study the Bodhisattva path, what is there in it to criticize? Is any of it harming to sentient, you know, does any of it harm sentient beings? Yeah? we talk about generosity and ethical conduct, fortitude, joyous effort, concentration, and meditation. Is anything there, you know, exhorting people to kill other people and have wars and lie and steal and, you know, do all sorts of horrible things to each other? No. They're all teachings, you know, that are teaching people about goodness. Yeah. So what is the point of saying the Buddha didn't teach the Mahayana? Yeah. If all these teachings are something really valuable for humanity and teach us how to be, you know, better people, then what's the use of criticizing? I do, and then His Holiness continues, I do not accept as literal everything found in Tibetan Buddhist literature about the history of Buddha Dharma. Whew. Some of it is clearly biased. I appreciate the efforts of Western historians who impartially try to analyze historical events. They try. Nevertheless, I think looking at the history of Buddhism just from the viewpoint of academic scholars, most of whom accept the existence of only this life, is going too far. From their perspective, many things mentioned in Buddhist scriptures would be impossible. However, with a worldview that includes belief in rebirth and the mind's ability to be totally purified and become omniscient, the scope of human experience expands greatly, and our view of history changes as well. Personally, I prefer to consider what seems most reasonable, given the view I have of who the Buddha was and what his capabilities were. So, one man, Bernard, you may remember him, was here. So he gave me a very small book on time, written by an Italian physicist. And I hardly understand anything of the book, but I made it my goal to read it. I'm almost done. But if you hear the little I understand from him, if you read this, you know, you could think that somebody who thinks like this is nuts, because he's saying that in the universe, there is no commonly accepted present. Yeah? And that time is not, and space too, are not something that exists outside. Yeah? But their perspectives on what is going on, and that, events are defined when different systems of, you know, gravity and heat and all these other things, when they come in contact, and then you produce phenomena. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, reading this, and like I said, I don't understand much of it, but, you know, if he weren't a physicist with a degree, most people would read that and say, you know, these guys are completely out of their minds. What are they talking about, you know? That you can't differentiate between past, present, and future, you know, or that time doesn't exist. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. I mean, we saw even, you know, Galileo. What was it he discovered? Was he the one who said that the world was round? Yeah. So, he said that the earth revolves around the sun. Yeah, I mean, they called him a heretic. They thought he was crazy and out of his mind. Yeah, so, anything that is a little bit different than the ordinary, people think is crazy. In summary, because Shakyamuni Buddha was a fully awakened individual, he knew the spiritual dispositions of different audiences and guided them accordingly, teaching them what was suitable. So this is Christina in response to what you asked. Because the number of spiritual aspirants receptive to the Mahayana teachings was so small at the time of the Buddha, he gave those teachings only to a limited group. These teachings remained in a very small pockets of people and almost disappeared. But for our good fortune, they didn't. Nagarjuna made a special effort to collect them and teach them, and for that reason, he is known as a trailblazer. Then I piped up and put in my idea. Personally speaking, I approach the issue of authenticity from a different perspective than those presented above. Having graduated with a degree in history, I'm aware that written histories are partial, both in the sense that the information is not complete and that writers interpret it from their own perspective. Over the years, I've had the fortune to study the Mahayana Sutras and commentaries. Even though my knowledge and understanding are very limited, these teachings made sense to me when I examined them using reason. They also produce beneficial effects when I apply them in my life. If such profound and effective teachings were not given by a fully awakened being such as the Buddha, who else would have had the ability to do so? Certainly not limited sentient beings. In short, my experience with these sutras only confirms my conviction that they are the Buddha's word. While I enjoy learning the different perspectives of the history of Buddhism, my faith is not based on it.
Do you remember when or where His Holiness was teaching this?
A lot of this came from a private interview. Yeah. Because I asked him, I said, you know, people are saying this, and it's a big subject, and what do you have to say on it? And this is what he said. And also, I remember in one of the conferences with the Western Buddhist teachers, somebody brought up and said, you know, because there were a few of the teachers there who were questioning the authenticity of the Mahayana. And somebody said, well, couldn't it have been somebody who was really wise, who had a lot of latencies in their mind, and these latencies ripened, and then they wrote the sutras afterwards based on that? Or couldn't the Buddha have spoken through different people, you know, like he did with the Heart Sutra? Yeah, couldn't the Buddha have done that? And so people wrote these sutras later. And the Buddha, His Holiness, he didn't agree with that.
I just think it's funny how the idea of magic discredits Buddhism here in the West. Because as you well know, in Asia, it brings people to Buddhism.
Right.
And when I first met the Dharma, my first two teachers had to, I mean, they would talk about like supernormal powers and whatever. And they always had to emphasize like those are just side effects. They are not the goal. Like it is about liberation and awakening. Yeah. You know, just the emphasis is different. And I attended this class on the Yogacara Bhumi Shastra where we never got beyond the eight consciousnesses and people kept asking questions about ghosts. The poor Venerable who was teaching.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. In that culture, the supernormal invokes faith. In our culture, it invokes skepticism. Yeah.
But also interest.
Yeah. Yeah, from some quarters, some interest. Yeah.
You also know that His Holiness at least once mentioned that he recollected his encounter with Buddha in one of his previous lives. From his teachings, he mentioned somewhere that he remembered himself offering a crystal rosary or something to Buddha. Okay, I have to look for it.
Yeah, so, would you look for that?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm good. So nobody heard this?
Somebody asked a question at Deer Park in the U.S. About, like, if you...
Something along the line of... He's always saying, you know, I don't really have much... realization or something like that, mm-hmm. And then the person got really discouraged, like, if you don't have anything, what about us? And then he said, like, he vaguely remembered himself very far away when the Buddha was there, and like he was like in the audience very far away. So that was in the Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive by Lama Zopa, saying that this conversation happened in Deer Park.
Huh. Hmm?
Oh, really? Huh. I didn't know about that. Yeah, usually His Holiness doesn't say things like that. Yeah, it helped that person.
I find it interesting the correlation you drew between the four establishments of mindfulness and how they relate to Tantra. And
you didn't understand what I said.
I found it interesting.
Oh.
And just as thinking of, would you say that you see it as one replacing the other in terms of, or one being a foundation for the other?
Building on the other. Yeah. 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 You start out with your body that you have now that you can get in touch with, and you really understand that. And then later, you know, you go into Tantra and then understand the body and feelings and mind on a very different level. And I think, actually, my personal feeling is I think many people, before they even understand their present body, they're already visualizing themselves having a deity's body. And then they get very confused, yeah, because they don't have an understanding of emptiness. I mean, you have to have an understanding of emptiness to otherwise visualizing yourself as the deity, what are you doing? Yeah, it sounds like Mickey Mouse. Or you think you're a truly existent deity and then you get very arrogant. I talked to somebody once and that's what happened to her. Yeah. So that's why they say, you know, time to get a stable foundation and then go to Tantra later on. It shouldn't be widely disseminated. Yeah, you found it?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is from where?
Heart of the Path by Lama Zopa Rinpoche.
Okay.
During one of His Holiness' visits to Deer Park, Geshe Zopa Rinpoche Center in Madison, Wisconsin, His Holiness said in the teachings, "As His Holiness often does, I have no realization of bodhicitta or emptiness or anything else, but I have strong faith in them." Later during a group interview, somebody asked His Holiness, "You say you don't have any realization. So how is it possible for us? We have no hope." As this was expressed strongly, His Holiness had to respond in some way, so he let slip from his holy mouth as a kind of private comment, "Actually, I remember that I was with Shakyamuni Buddha in India." So I don't see any other comments.
Yeah, he's not claiming to have any realizations there, is he? No, he's just saying he remembers, has a memory of being, you know, in the Buddha's audience. Yeah. Well, I was talking with Circum Rinpoche one day, and he said, "Have you ever dreamt in your dreams of, you know, have you ever dreamt of the Buddha?" I said, "No." I said, "Have you?" And he had, you know. So, yeah, even, you know, we dream of our teachers sometimes, but do we dream of the Buddha? Yeah. Some beings do. Not me. Yeah, not yet. Okay. Sometime in the future. I'll wake up one morning. You'll hear me scream, "I dreamt of the Buddha." And he was saying, "You got this part in the book all wrong. What are you doing writing this stuff?" Yeah, wouldn't that?
You can ask him to review the whole series.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That would, I'd love him to. Yeah. Well, you know, when I heard Tsongkhapa being able to ask questions to Manjushri, it was like, oh, I wish I could do that. You know, some of these passages or some of these topics are very confusing. Okay. Oh, yeah.
I was thinking about like how, Tsongkhapa saw Manjushri and Sangha saw Maitreya. And it's easy to have this desire to see and to receive direct, but we have so many teachings and we're so blessed with the teachings we have that we hardly even can, you know, we need to practice what we have been given.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Because if we don't understand the teachings that we've had already, what is, and we can't ask an intelligent question, then what is Manjushri going to say to us? You know, go to the audio library and listen to when His Holiness talked about Gaia. Your answer is there. Then meditate on it, please. You know?